Salvador Dali meets Rikers Island today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. In 1965, Salvador Dali's agent ran into the head of the New York City jail system at a dinner party. They came up with a plan to have Dali visit Rikers Island prison.
He was going to both paint with the inmates and also give them critiques.
But Dali got sick on the day he was supposed to go, so
he slapped a painting together in about 2 hours of the crucifixion, and then he had a good friend of his deliver it to Rikers as an apology.
That painting went basically unnoticed inside the prison for 40 years, until it was stolen. Ocean's 11, but better. That story and much more coming your way right here today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Glad you could be with us today. We're starting off with the latest in a long-running spat. You know that one, between Senator Elizabeth Warren and President Donald Trump. For years, even before getting to the White House, he called her Pocahontas, taunting her for her claim of Native American ancestry.
I've got more Indian blood in me than Pocahontas, and I have none.
This week, Warren responded with a genetic analysis that suggests she does have a Native ancestor. But Native Americans say she's missing the point and that identity is a whole lot more complicated than DNA. The World's Roopa Shenoy takes a deeper look.
Along with the DNA report, Warren released this video.
Because my mother's family, the Reeds, was part Native American.
It's old black and white photos interspersed with members of Warren's family in Norman, Oklahoma, reminiscing about the stories their elders used to tell.
I'm not enrolled in a tribe, and only tribes determine tribal citizenship. I understand and respect that distinction, but my family history is my family history.
Graham Lee Brewer hears that a lot and is a contributing editor for Tribal Affairs at High Country News.
And I'm Cherokee, and I'm not much darker than her.
Her being Warren. Brewer understands her desire to honor family stories.
Growing up in Oklahoma, a lot of people have a story about a Native ancestor or a Native relative, and they think, yeah, I was told by my family that I'm part Native.
But, he says, that's actually pretty easy to verify. And in the case of the Cherokee Nation, the process doesn't involve a DNA test.
Tracing your Native heritage or lineage is actually very simple for a lot of people because when the U.S. government was attempting to commit genocide on Native peoples, they documented us meticulously.
Nearly 200 years ago, the U.S. government agreed on a policy of removing Native Americans from their land. American officials defined people as Native American based on their ancestry. They called it blood quantum, basically what percentage of your blood is Native. About two-thirds of the tribes in the U.S. still use the amount of ancestry that a person has in that tribe to determine citizenship, says Eva Garut, a Cherokee citizen and retired research professor at Boston College. She says the other third don't use that criteria anymore because as people started marrying outside of the tribes, some children and grandchildren couldn't meet the standard to qualify. So those tribes instead ask members for proof that they're descended from one of the people on the U.S. government lists made so long ago.
They want to know whether someone's family identified in formal political legal terms with the tribe.
In other words, if an ancestor identified as Native with all the benefits and drawbacks, like racism, that came with that distinction, that earns them citizenship, not DNA, Garut says, because Cherokee isn't a racial group. It's a legal and political term for someone who's a citizen of a sovereign nation, just like citizens of, say, France or the U.S.
The bottom line is that when you put the question, who is an Indian person, the only thing you can really meaningfully say is who's asking and for what purpose.
And the purpose may be very personal. Kim Tallbear is an associate professor of Native Studies at the University of Alberta. She's descended from the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes of Oklahoma. And she thinks some people want to identify as Native so they don't feel implicated in American colonialism.
And to assuage one's guilt with being somebody who has benefited from the genocide and dispossession of Indigenous peoples from their land, as many Americans have. So I think if somebody can claim that they're Native American, they don't feel implicated in that.
With the Trump-Warren spat, Rebecca Nagel says American leaders are again leading the conversation about who is Native, not Native people. Nagel's a member of the Cherokee Nation and says she's been criticized by other Democrats for speaking out against Warren on this issue, including in appearances on Fox News.
And these are people who have the power and the authority to shape policy over our tribes. And if those people really, really believe that DNA tests have any legitimacy when in a conversation about Native identity, to me, that's very scary.
Because Nagel already has her identity questioned.
When people see me on the street, I look like a white person. And I think that so many white people who aren't Cherokee claiming to be Cherokee puts me constantly on the defensive. People on my Facebook and on my Twitter feed will be like, well, you don't look Cherokee. You look just like Elizabeth Warren.
For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
Fake news and misinformation spreading online, those are big worries here in the U.S., especially with the midterms looming. But we also know that this has been a major problem in many other countries and led to violence and oppression, like in Myanmar. We've heard a lot about Facebook's problems there recently, like how fake news, hate speech, all sorts of problematic content went unchecked on the platform for years, and how those posts were part of a coordinated campaign. It was a campaign meant to stoke already existing divisions in the country, mostly against the Rohingya ethnic minority. What we didn't know was who exactly was behind it all. We do now. An investigation by the New York Times is pointing to Myanmar's own military. Reporter Paul Moser says the military was the main player behind the propaganda efforts on Facebook.
You know, in 2012, 2013, 2014, there was kind of this exploratory effort. And you know, there was maybe 10 or 20, 30 people posted to do this. But then as the power of the network became clear, you know, kind of from 2014 onwards, the military started throwing a lot more resources. So in recent years, you had hundreds of military officers on it. And these people worked in shifts. They opened up thousands and thousands of troll accounts. They would use them to attack people who attacked the military. They would use them to kind of spew hate speech. They would use them even just to provoke battles in the comments. So, you know, they would take both sides of a fight, start a fight, and then move away as other people joined in to sort of squabbling. And then they also had these really big fake accounts that they could use as propaganda outlets. So, you know, pop star fan pages or beauty queen fan pages or maybe sort of fake news pages. They would use those to spread rumors. And one of the sort of most pernicious examples of this came last year on the anniversary of 9/11. Basically, there were two messages going around. One was spread to Muslim communities and said Buddhists were going to attack them. And the other was spread to Buddhist communities and said Muslims were going to wage jihadist attacks against them. So you have two fake messages going out against the two major groups, basically spurring fear. And the entire country, you know, at least the main areas, Yangon and Mandalay, came to a standstill out of fear. And what we found was that that was actually planted by the military. And the idea was to create a kind of sense of insecurity and a feeling that there's the need to have the military to have that security.
So when we talk about the Burmese military here taking on this campaign, are we talking about extremist kind of fringe elements within the military doing an ad hoc kind of thing, or was it really organized from the top down?
No, this is very intentional and very well organized. I mean, there are three different groups in particular within the military that were responsible for this. So this was extremely intentional. This was run the way you would run a military operation or campaign. This was not some kind of, you know, group of people in a room that nobody else knew about. This was a sort of intentional thing that has been going on for a long time.
It starts to sound a lot like the Kremlin's Internet Research Agency.
Right, exactly. And we were, you know, we were looking for links to that, and we couldn't exactly nail those links, but there is a Russian connection there. The Myanmar military has had ties to Russia for a long time, but in the early 2000s, out of fear from what people told us of being too reliant on China, they started sending a lot of soldiers to Russia to study. And they would study medicine, they would study computers, they would also study psychological warfare and hacking. And then they bring those lessons back. So as this relates to Facebook, we heard they did learn how to manipulate Facebook, but what was more important actually was less kind of the ins and outs of setting up troll accounts and things like that, because just about, you know, you can figure that out if you know how to use Facebook. The important part was kind of understanding the actual psychological warfare itself, how to create compelling fake news and you know, memes that would get people's attention.
So when fake news was kind of a new thing on the internet, memes were flying around, Facebook didn't do much, you said. What about once the military had their own campaign of fake news? What did Facebook do to stop it?
Right. So for a long time, they didn't do anything. And there wasn't enough resources directed at Myanmar to even understand that there was this big intentional campaign going on. So for years, they basically, the military waged a propaganda war with no actual opponent. Now, over the past 6 or so months, starting at the beginning of this year, Facebook started doing an investigation into this. In May, they found some pretty solid links between the military and some of these campaigns. And so at that point, some of them came down. But there were still a lot more out there. And so, you know, as we were investigating, we found that, you know, for instance, this entertainment link. So there were all these fake pop star pages that were being used by the military. So once we sort of showed Facebook that, they did some of their research and found, sure enough, that that was connected as well. So I think it's one of these things where they've started to unravel it. But like there's still, you know, if you keep, you can always find new strands because there's so much activity out there. And so there's still, the investigation is still ongoing.
What has been the biggest challenge for Facebook tackling fake news in Myanmar?
A lot of it has to do with two things, basically, language and the cultural context. You have to be able to hire people who can read all of these posts and understand the cultural context they're coming from. A lot of people complain that the people that Facebook has hired sometimes haven't lived in Myanmar for a decade, so they may not be sort of up to date on the newest memes or the newest references, and so they might miss some of the stuff. So I think, you know, and at this point, they have, I think, about 70 people doing content reviews. They're going to up it to 100. But the question is, you know, when you have 18 million people doing this in a military campaign with hundreds of people, you know, how many people do you need to kind of personally review all this stuff? And the answer is a lot more than 100, I think.
I mean, it is really kind of extraordinary, the story. You've got a government weaponizing social media against its own people. Are there any examples of governments anywhere else in the world that are doing this?
So Myanmar is a pretty galling example. I'm not really aware of that having been done anywhere else. And, you know, a lot of it comes back to the legacy of the Myanmar military. It's, you know, Myanmar is a very complex country, but it's worth remembering that the most powerful political organization in Myanmar remains the military. And it, you know, technically gave up power and kind of brought up this, you know, allowed for this democracy to happen. But it still sits behind in the shadows and it's still the most powerful actor in the country. And so this is one of the ways that it's tried to kind of wield that power from the shadows to make sure it remains relevancy, even as, you know, democracy has started to kind of, you know, take root and become a thing in the country.
Congress, as you know, has been pressing Silicon Valley to clamp down on this stuff by kind of tightening up their own systems, making them more rigorous. But are you also seeing evidence that Washington is not pressing these governments, like the Myanmar government, to stop this kind of online campaign as hard as it could?
Certainly, I think it's the kind of thing that now that it's out there, governments do need to push back harder. And certainly we've seen the U.S. government, you know, in the Trump administration be somewhat flip about the social media campaigns that the Russians have done. And, you know, we see that playbook now spreading pretty quickly. And so I think it's worth having governments do more and stand up more, because also as negligent as Facebook has been, to some degree, it is hard to put all of the onus on a company. You know, if you have one corporate actor, they're dealing with the Myanmar military and their 70 years of propaganda history in, say, Myanmar. In China, they're talking to the Chinese Communist Party and trying to wheel and deal to get in there. Then in Vietnam, they're dealing with another, you know, cloistered, secretive government that's throwing a new law at them. I mean, basically, if you're Facebook and you have to manage this problem, you basically need your own State Department and you need to start basically looking like a government. So I do think it's important that governments come out here and give some cover and give some protection to these companies, because the problems they're facing are intractable and they're so large that you need sort of, you know, the power of real nation states to kind of weigh in and at least set some kind of a guide, you know.
Paul Moser of The New York Times, thanks a lot. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Marco.
You're listening to The World.
Today's podcast is sponsored by Babbel. People around the world are learning new languages with the Babbel language learning app. Learn Spanish, French, Italian, German, Russian, Swedish, and more with Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons. You'll learn through interactive dialogues, speech recognition, and fun trainers and quizzes. Many people learn to speak new languages with confidence in just a few short weeks, and Babbel is available as an app or online. And right now, you can try Babbel for free. Go to babbel.com or download the app and try it for free. That's Babbel, B-A-B-B-E-L.com, or download the app to try it for free, babbel.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. 50 years ago today, an iconic moment at the Mexico City Olympics. U.S. sprinters Tommy Smith and John Carlos raised their fists in the air with their national anthem playing in the background. It was during a medal ceremony at the Olympic Stadium. Smith had won gold in the 200-meter race. Carlos got the bronze. That day in Mexico City, the world saw two athletes protesting racial and economic inequalities back home in the U.S. It had a big impact on the lives of many athletes who competed in the Mexico City Games. My colleague Esteban Butillos here at WGBH in Boston spoke with two members of the 1968 U.S. team to hear how they remember what happened 50 years ago.
Andrew Larkin's home in Northampton is a memorial to his glory days of rowing for Harvard. Two massive oars, inscribed with accomplishments like winning times against Yale and appearances in international races, hang over the door to his porch. His walls are adorned with black and white photos of young men sporting the Crimson signature H on their chests. Larkin pulls out a record from 1968, the most important year in his athletic career.
This is my scrapbook that I've kept.
That year, Larkin and his Harvard teammates represented the United States at the Summer Olympics in Mexico City, where American runners John Carlos and Tommy Smith turned the world on its head by raising two fists in the air. 10 days before the opening ceremony, police and military troops in Mexico City opened fire on thousands of unarmed student protesters, killing hundreds. For Larkin and the Harvard crew, it was hard to stay focused just on college and rowing because there was so much turmoil in this country.
It was a time where you had to get involved, or at least we felt that. It's a little silly to be playing around in boats when the whole world is going to hell.
Heading into the Olympics, there was talk of black athletes sitting out of the games to protest racism. The Harvard crew, who were all white, wanted to help, so they drafted a letter that stated their support for the black Olympians and reached out to other athletes as well.
We didn't have any idea that we're going to do anything more audacious.
But not every member of the crew signed on to the letter. And the boycott? It never came to pass.
I had ran in the snow. I ran in Franklin Park in the cold in the morning. And if somebody tells you to boycott, you know, a lot of people gave up a lot of stuff for those events.
That's Leon Coleman, a hurdler for the 68 team from the South End who finished fourth in his race. He says many athletes also feared repercussions back home if they demonstrated. Coleman was in the stadium when Smith and Carlos came in first and third in the 200-meter final. When the Star Spangled Banner came on over the stadium speakers, Smith and Carlos each raised a single black gloved fist in silence.
All of a sudden, we saw some black gloves and we saw some fists go up. It was a shock for everybody and people really was amazed about it.
The consequences were immediate. Smith and Carlos were both expelled from the Olympic Village and faced death threats upon coming home. Neither ran in the Olympics ever again. But they weren't the only ones who faced blowback. The president of the U.S. Olympic Committee sent a letter to Harvard's crew coach expressing his displeasure with the team's actions.
Serious intellectual degeneration has taken place in this once great university. If you and your several members of your crew are examples of the type of men that are within its walls, there's this hate mail with a letterhead.
Amira Rose Davis, a history professor at Penn State and a host of the feminist sports podcast Burn It All Down, says today athletes have even more impact than they did in 68.
So I think as long as our society is obsessed with sports and pour as much money and time into it, it will always create a platform. These spaces have been kind of concocted to be this utopia free from politics, even though, you know, it's always been there.
Their actions in 68 inspired both admiration and hate for Smith and Carlos. And whether it's a raised fist or a bent knee, the emotional reactions to athletes protesting during the national anthem remain strong.
For the world, Esteban Bustillos, Boston.
You can see that iconic photo from the 1968 Olympics again. Go to theworld.org. You'll find it there. Another memorable Olympic moment now. It's from the 1992 Summer Games in Barcelona. British athlete Derek Redmond was getting ready for the race of his life, the 400-meter semifinal, after overcoming serious physical problems just to make it to the Games.
But by the time I was in Barcelona, I felt great. There was no issues, no problems.
Derek Redmond, the best form he's shown since he broke the British record, which was way back in 87.
And I remember thinking, I'm going to win this race. The gun goes.
Wow.
And I had a really good start.
Redmond's got off very fast indeed.
I'm flowing down the back straight. And as I describe it, I hear a funny pop. And two or three strides later is then when I felt it. And I felt the sort of the rip of the hamstring.
Redmond has broken down. He's on the track, kneeling down. And Derek Redmond, well, his injury problem, the jinx has struck again.
And I just remember having my hand on the back of the leg and just sort of collapsing to the floor in pain. Then I remembered where I was. And it was just like, you're in the Olympic semi-final. And that's pretty much what made me get up and start to run or hobble. And I just thought, you know what? I'm going to finish this race. It might be the last race I ever run, so I'm going to finish it. Not for anybody else, I'm going to finish it for me. And I was just about to start into the home straight when I could sense this person on my left-hand side. And then I heard a very familiar voice shout out, Derek, it's me. And instantly I knew who it was. It was my dad. Up until then, I'd managed to keep all my emotions in and hold it together relatively well. But as soon as I saw him, that was it. And, you know, I lost it all and I was in tears. I can't believe this has happened. Why me? You know.
With his track record and injuries, it may be his only Olympic appearance. He just can't hold it.
He would always have been there with me. And he spent many a year standing on the sidelines in the middle of the winter with a coffee in his hands, trying to keep warm. And all he was saying was, look, you've got nothing to prove. You're a champion to us. You'll be back. Don't worry. We'll do this together. I just said to him, get me back into lane five. I want to finish. Just get me back into lane five. And the joke that I always make about that is the first and last and only time I've ever been able to shout at my dad and get away with it. You know, any other time as a kid, you would have got a quick smack round here and told, oi, less of your cheek. We still had officials trying to stop us. And they're not quite sure what to do. They're thinking, who's this crazy man that's just walked onto the track? What's going on? All this sort of stuff. And right up until the point I'd gone over the line and walked through the line, I had no idea the reaction it was having on the crowd. So I sort of, you know, had a look around. People were going absolutely mad. Everyone was on their feet and all this sort of stuff. Some of the messages and letters and stuff that I get from people say, you know, you have no idea who I am. I'm not in sport. I've been through, you know, some hard times. Just want to thank you for your inspiration. It's quite strange that people to this day still find it, you know, inspiring. It's a nice feeling that I've done something that has helped so many people in their own ways. There was an outside chance of having a battle for a gold. Does it make up for that? I have to be honest and say no.
Former track star Derek Redmond and the injury that ended his Olympic dreams in Barcelona back in 1992. He was speaking there with our colleagues at the BBC. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, a new report from Amnesty International. It says the U.S. government dramatically underestimated the number of families separated from their kids at the U.S. border.
There still hasn't been a full reckoning by the Department of Homeland Security into the full scale of abuse under the zero tolerance policy.
Where we are with family separations, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Here's a story we're probably going to hear a lot about in the run-up to the midterm elections next month. Another caravan of migrants heading north from Central America. Yes, we could, chanted the migrants after crossing from Honduras into Guatemala yesterday. Today, President Trump threatened to cut off aid to Honduras if the migrants continue their march. Guatemalan journalist Luisa Sardo has been watching the progress of the caravan.
It's heartbreaking to see that amount of people marching, singing, praying with children and babies and elderly people. They are just walking. And if you see the shoes, the clothing is not appropriate to the weather conditions here in Guatemala. We have a lot of rainy seasons right now. So they will reach the Mexican border, I think, on Sunday. And this will be a very huge crisis in the border.
So they're on their way now to Guatemala City, the 1,600 marchers, right? What is the scene as they're walking along? Are they walking along a highway?
Last night, they stepped in Esquipulas. Esquipulas is a big city near the border with Honduras. And there were around 2,000 people on the park and shelter and everywhere. They were sleeping almost on the street.
So the caravan started in San Pedro Sula in Honduras. San Pedro Sula was once the murder capital of the world. It's still a dangerous city. Why do the marchers say they're fleeing Honduras?
Violence, gang violence. And the other part is they are with nothing. Not having jobs and not having any money makes them very vulnerable.
Yeah, so fleeing poverty, we've heard a lot about that. And the violence as well. I mean, there was a Honduran congressman, Hadi Dixon, who tweeted, they are not seeking the American dream, they're fleeing a Honduran nightmare. So that certainly squares with the violence and the violent stories we're hearing. Luis, why are they doing this march this time of year? Why now?
It was random. They just gather people and begin to march.
It is legal to seek asylum in the U.S., even if you don't have papers. So people who present themselves at ports of entry are not violating any laws. How much do these migrants know that large segments of American society are not going to welcome them?
As far as I can see, only a few of them know about asylum. The other ones are just marching to the border. I think they believe they can just enter the countries. I don't think they are aware of the situation on the border.
Vice President Mike Pence told presidents in the region in Central America this week to stop migrants from fleeing north, and President Trump has threatened to cut off aid to Honduras. But are leaders in the region able to stop these marchers?
As far as I can know, here in Guatemala, they are not doing anything to stop them because it's not possible. We don't have enough resources to stop them and get them back to the border with Honduras because there are a lot of families, a lot of children, a lot of elderly people, and they are just crossing every road they can.
The United States provides about $175 million in aid to Honduras. That was the last fiscal year. If President Trump cut off that aid, what would that do to Honduras, do you think?
Oh, it's going to be very, very bad for Honduras' economy.
How would Guatemala feel if these Honduran migrants were to just stay in Guatemala? How would people feel about that?
People are not happy with the Honduras marchers here. There are, of course, a lot of people helping them and giving them food, water, medicine, because they are just crossing the country. But if they want to stay with no resources, with no money, just staying in the parks, that is a huge crisis, humanitarian crisis.
Guatemalan journalist Luis Asardo keeping his eyes on nearly 2,000 Honduran marchers who are moving through Guatemala. He's been speaking with us from Guatemala City. Luis, thank you.
Thanks to you.
There is a lot of uncertainty facing migrants who make it to the U.S.-Mexico border, especially families with children. Under the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy, thousands of families have been separated at the border. In fact, according to a recent report by Amnesty International, thousands more families were separated than the government has previously disclosed. Brian Griffey is a researcher at Amnesty International.
Imagine this. A Brazilian grandmother named Maria flees death threats by a police officer who was involved with criminal groups in Brazil. She had a developmentally disabled grandson over whom she had legal custody. We visited her in detention in El Paso. She had been there for almost a year after simply seeking protection at the U.S.-Mexico border. After a day or two in detention, they separated them from each other, and they remained separated for most of the next year. The grandson was put into the custody of the Connecticut State Children's Services, and they'd even sought to strip her of her legal guardianship. This is clearly not in the best interest of the child, and it was something that was done clearly also to compel her to give up her asylum claim and go back to Brazil. A few years ago, this would have been a clear-cut asylum case.
We'll get back to the case of Maria and her grandson, but first I wanted Griffey to tell us about the new Amnesty International report.
Basically, what we know is that the Department of Homeland Security has not made public an official count on the families and the number of children affected. What we hear from authorities are kind of a patchwork of conflicting statistics. The Department of Homeland Security, from April 19 to August 15 alone, separated over 6,000 family members who'd crossed the border irregularly. But from the numbers they shared with us, it appears that numbers about 20-25% higher at a minimum. Even when they provided us with these statistics, they couldn't tell us whether they were talking about the number of individuals or the number of families they separated. That's a big difference. They also pointed back to a class action lawsuit under which there had been about 2,500-2,600 families that were separated. But it appears that about 800 other people were separated beyond what they'd disclosed under this class action lawsuit.
Your report lays out three ways that the Trump administration policies affect people coming to the U.S. for asylum. One of those is obviously family separation. What are the others?
Well, the reason that the Trump administration was separating families was not just to be cruel. It wanted to detain all asylum seekers indefinitely. If you're detaining refugees only based on their migration status and they don't present any kind of risk to society or a risk of fleeing, that constitutes arbitrary detention under international law. And then right now, along the entire length of the U.S.-Mexico border, the Trump administration is pushing thousands of asylum seekers back into Mexico and telling them that it's safe for them to wait there. We also found that the U.S. authorities have been encouraging Mexican immigration officials to deport those asylum seekers back to the very countries where they fled persecution or threats of death. And that's flatly illegal under both U.S. law and international law. So there are these three interlocking policies. And since we released our report, both Republican and Democratic members of Congress have come to us asking for more information. We're hopeful that as we get closer to the appropriations process, that Congress can use the power of the purse to compel the Department of Homeland Security to be more forthcoming.
Back now to Maria, the Brazilian grandmother seeking asylum in the U.S. with her grandson. Brian Griffey says Amnesty International was present at Maria's final immigration hearing, and it wasn't looking good for her.
We actually witnessed as the judge sought to compel her in the courtroom to give up her asylum claim in order to be reunited with her grandson with special needs before being deported back to Brazil. The implication was all asylum claims are meritless, right? So he's saying, we want to close all the loopholes, but we can reunite you with your grandson so you don't get deported without him. So what you see here is a clear threat of permanently separating this grandmother from her grandson at the threat of being deported without him. And what we saw in terms of both the grandmother and the grandson is that the long-term consequences are grave. She actually had a medical emergency where she had to be rushed to the hospital because her health deteriorated so much from the mental anguish of being separated from her grandson with special needs. And she presented this in court, and still they prolonged her detention. Finally, actually, it was only when a congressperson, Beto O'Rourke, got involved that she was released and able to go reunite with her grandson.
Where are Maria and her grandson today?
They're in Connecticut. He's still under state custody. She was seeking to move from weekend visits to having guardianship over him again, but she has to go through the bureaucratic hoops while she also appeals her asylum claim. I spoke with her a few weeks ago, and she said, you know, I need to go to a psychologist. The scars are deep. I forget what I was saying. I can't sleep at night. It was all the symptoms that I've identified when I've worked in war zones. But she told me, you know, that when she first saw him, he wasn't being taken care of properly. He was in this heavily air-conditioned room, just shivering, saying, you know, mommy, mommy, why did you leave me here? And that every time they leave each other after a visit all day, they both go through this suffering because they're reliving the moment of their separation.
That was Amnesty International's Brian Griffey. Another story now about family separations, this one with a twist. This started about 70 years ago when the border between Alaska and Russia was officially closed. It was the start of the Cold War, and the Soviet Union imposed what was called the Ice Curtain. The border finally reopened about three decades ago, but even though travel is possible, a lot of families who live on both sides of the Bering Sea remain split. Emily Schwing recently spent a week with one family waiting to make the trip from Nome to Chukotka in Russia.
In a tiny kitchen in an apartment in Nome, Valentina Kanuka cooks a big pot of borscht.
So do the onions go into the borscht?
Mm-hmm. Borscht.
Borscht. Did I say it right?
Mm-hmm. Now you do.
It's that R rolling.
Borscht.
This is dinner for her two daughters, a friend, and me. All of us try to keep our minds off the weather that's kept us grounded here on the west side of the Bering Strait.
I want to visit my parents. I passed away many years ago. Also my brother, too.
Kanuka plans to lay flowers on her parents' graves, not to say goodbye.
to say hello.
Kanuka actually lives in Gamble, Alaska, a small village on St. Lawrence Island in the Bering Sea. It's only about 80 miles as the crow flies from there to Novo Chaplino. That's the tiny coastal village where Kanuka grew up in Russia. It's also where three of her sisters, a brother, nephews, an aunt, and many of her friends still live. Kanuka isn't really that far from home, but getting there is tough. For starters, the runway on the Russian side often gets fogged in, grounding airplanes on Alaska's side of the international dateline. So we wait in a friend's apartment in Nome.
And who taught you how to make borscht?
I watched my mom. I watched my mom and then my sister. My sister make it differently.
In 1994, when she was living in Novo Chaplino, Kanuka met an Alaska native from Gamble. She moved with him to Alaska and gave birth to her oldest daughter, Marina, a year later. In 2003, she became a U.S. citizen. She's only been back to Russia twice to reconnect. As she stirs the borscht, she talks about gathering subsistence foods and cooking them with her daughters. Things she learned growing up in Russia that translate well to her life in Alaska.
Me and my kids go pick rose root.
What's that called?
Rose root.
Rose root.
Mm-hmm. We also have fireweed.
These stories make 23-year-old Marina tear up, just as one of the two daily jets that land in Nome passes overhead.
I see people in Gamble, and they're always with their family, you know? And then I have to travel all the way over there just to see the rest of my family.
Many people at all levels of government have tried to make travel across the Bering Strait easier for people indigenous to the region. There's a visa-free travel program, but you have to have a formal invitation from a family member on the other side. And that invitation has to be reviewed by both Russian and U.S. officials. You can only go through specific entry points, Anadyr or Provodinia in Russia, and Nome in Alaska. And a visit is limited to 90 days.
Your families right now, the elders are dying. You can't go because cost prohibitive, you know, and the politics.
That's George Nunguk, an Alaska Native elder. He's in his 70s. Nunguk leads a dance and drum group from Savunga, the only other village on St. Lawrence Island.
Boats would go across, or they would come across by boat, skin boat mostly, and wooden boats, the Boston Whalers, the white ones with black trimming.
But that was years ago. Boats no longer cross the Bering Strait with any regularity, mostly for safety reasons. Seas can be extremely rough, and the water is frigid. And the travel restrictions don't make it any easier. Now, people like Nunguk and Kanuka have to buy a plane ticket from their village to Nome for about $300. And then they have to charter a flight across to Russia, sometimes for more than $1,000. That's a lot of money if you live on St. Lawrence Island, where jobs are scarce. Most people, like Nunguk, just use WhatsApp and Facebook to stay connected with friends and family on the other side.
They show their dances, they post them on Facebook, and I can watch them. So it's good that way. But one-on-one, face-to-face, is more important because we're able to express our pleasure of meeting, re-meeting them. So it builds us with happiness and love, you know.
That's something apps just can't replicate. In the end, George Nunguk, Valentina Kanuka, and the rest of us didn't make it to Russia. Weather grounded us in Nome for a week before we finally gave up. But we'll try again next summer. For The World, Emily Schwing, Nome, Alaska.
Fact: Salvador Dali sometimes painted to music while an audience watched. Thank you, YouTube Archive, a flamenco singer and guitarist doing their thing as Dali worked on a painting of a conquistador on horseback. Maybe that's what Dali would have done on his planned visit to Rikers Island in 1965. But when the day came, Dali woke up in New York City sick with 101 fever. He canceled, and as an apology, he whipped up a quick painting in about 2 hours, a version of the crucifixion to be hung in the mess hall at Rikers Island.
After 20 years hanging up there, they took the painting down when someone threw a coffee cup at the painting and broke the glass casing it was in and actually stained part of the painting.
James Finelli with the Wall Street Journal has the yarn and wrote about it for Esquire. That story involves the Dali painting getting partly restored at one point, then sent back to Rikers. Then it's found in a trash can and put up in the warden's office. But this doesn't stop there. The story barely has a clear conclusion or beginning. So then in 2003, there's this fire drill, and it disappears.
Right. So the fire drill was supposed to be the perfect cover for this heist. It was a group of prison guards who worked at that jail decided to have a fire drill during the overnight shift. And that fire drill sent pretty much the entire staff to one wing of the jail away from the painting. And during that about 15-minute drill, three of the guards managed to take the painting down and replace it with a fake, and a not very good fake.
So they messed up the forgery. How long did it take until people noticed that Dali wasn't there anymore?
Not very long at all. The painting was snatched probably a little after 1 a.m., and about maybe 6 hours later, one of the guards noticed that something didn't seem right about that painting. Had another guard look at it with him, and they realized that it definitely wasn't a fake. And from there, they alerted the warden, who quickly cordoned off the area, and an investigator was called to find out what happened.
Right. This investigator, his name is Mike Caruso. He was with New York City and kind of in charge of finding bad internal affairs among corrections officers in the city and the like. Some suspicion landed on several wardens at Rikers, right?
That's right. Well, not wardens, but assistant deputy wardens. These are basically the highest level you can go in the ranks before you get appointed to being a warden. And during that graveyard shift, there was two of them, a guy named Benny Nuzzo and a guy named Mitchell Hockhauser. And they were basically the top men in charge that evening. So if something was going to happen, like a fire drill, they're the ones who would have called it. So suspicion immediately turned to them.
And Inspector Caruso starts seeing that there actually had been a plan afoot for some time. It was not an impulsive thing, right?
That's right. So ultimately, four guards are accused of taking the Dali. One of the guards, an officer named Timothy Pena, the morning after the heist, he is immediately racked with guilt and remorse over what happened. And he decides that he needs to unburden himself to investigators and tell them what happened. And he goes in 2 days after the heist to the investigators and says, I was part of this. I was instructed by Benny Nuzzo and Mitchell Hockhauser to steal this painting. And their plan was to sell it because they believed it was worth quite a lot of money. They were planning to sell it on the black market for $1 million. And Timothy Pena's cut was supposed to be $50,000. He was essentially supposed to be one of the lookout men, and ultimately he was involved in actually taking the painting down and putting up the fake, which, by the way, they put up the fake with a stapler. So, again, it wasn't
right.
The best.
Not terribly
It wasn't the best replica. So once Mike Caruso had Timothy Pena talking to him, he wanted the officer to help him even more. So they convinced him to wear a wire. And later that evening, he met up with another one of the guards. This time it's a guard named Gregory Sokol. And they met at a little donut shop in Staten Island. Timothy Pena and Greg Sokol again talk about what happened, and they're both filled with remorse and paranoia that they're going to be caught. And unbeknownst to Gregory Sokol, you know, Timothy Pena is wearing a wire. So once the conversation is over, investigators swoop in and they take Gregory Sokol into custody, who, once he's taken into custody, also unburdens himself about the heist and again points the finger at Mitchell Hockhauser and Benny Nuzzo as the ringleaders. So he convinces Gregory Sokol to wear a wire himself. And later that evening, when Sokol's supposed to start his graveyard shift at the jail, he and Benny Nuzzo and Mitchell Hockhauser agreed to meet and just talk about all the heat that's on them about this heist. And they meet in an old locker room underneath the jail where there's like a hissing boiler and there's music playing from a nearby weight room for the officers. And they discuss the case. Depending on who you ask, investigators would say that Benny Nuzzo and Mitchell Hockhauser implicate themselves in those conversations, and they, you know, talk about how the heat is on them. They talk about how this would never have happened if they had used a better replica. And the investigators, after they have this, they get this recording of the conversation, they feel like they have enough to at least execute a search warrant on Benny Nuzzo's house, rather his Benny Nuzzo's mother's house. They ransack it. They, you know, open up filled in fireplaces. They look in the ceilings. They don't find it.
So there's some implication from the 2003 heist that it wasn't the first one. This Dali is still on the art loss list even today because the one stolen in 2003 may not have been the original. What's that about?
Benny, who spoke to me for the article, he had his thoughts about what happened to it. He thought that, you know, that painting had changed hands so many times over the years. You know, it was in the cafeteria, then it was boxed up, and then it was sent away to a gallery in Virginia. Then it was boxed up again and kind of forgotten about and then found in a trash bin and then went to a warden's office. And he believes that somewhere along the way, maybe somebody else might have taken it, you know, when there was a little less chance of being caught. And so Benny thinks that the painting that they actually took from that lobby of that jail was already a fake, was already a replica, and that the original one had gone missing long ago.
I got to say, your story has enough yin-yang to it that I think Dali would really appreciate it himself.
It is. It's a surreal story.
James Finelli wrote The Great Rikers Island Art Heist for Esquire. Thanks so much for being with us. This is a great story.
Thanks very much.
The whereabouts of that Dali painting, by the way, still unknown. So keep your eyes peeled, you know, just in case. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.